in terms of sanctions with the incoming Biden administration. Biden was vice president, after all, under Obama when the Iran nuclear deal, when the JCPOA was negotiated, and reaffirmed earlier this month in an interview with the New York Times that the U.S. would rejoin the deal if Iran adheres to the agreement. Once again, this is a bit of a nonsensical statement because Iran has always adhered to the agreement and protocols of the JCPOA, whereas the United States did not and tore up the deal. So it's frankly ridiculous that the U.S. expects something from Iran. It's on the U.S. to show some goodwill and prove that they can engage in long-lasting diplomacy, not the other way around. It's worth noting that we've seen calls from Germany and the United States that they want to renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal, calling it a nuclear deal plus. But these are all iterations of the same thing. What they want is what Trump originally said, which is to curb Iran's ballistic missile program and to contain Iran's influence in the region and to stop it from resisting against the Zionist and American occupations. That's what it comes down to. They're all going back on what they originally agreed to, which is utterly absurd. Iran has made it absolutely clear that they will not renegotiate the nuclear deal. I mean, why should they? The P5 plus one couldn't even follow the original nuclear deal. Iran did, and was treated with disdain in return. So as long as there's a clear understanding between the two sides that the sanctions are lifted, then perhaps there will be a return to some sort of normalcy in that regard. However, what a lot of media stenographers and some of the U.S. own allies are saying is that they want to renegotiate this deal, get rid of Iran's nuclear capabilities and ballistic missile program, and cripple the access of resistance. This is off the table, and that's not happening. After the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Dr. Fakhrizadeh last month, the Iranian parliament passed a draft resolution that sets out to enrich more of Iran's uranium up to 20%, which is much higher than the 3.67% set out in the JCPOA, and to beef up its nuclear program in 2 months' time. That time frame is no accident. What they're doing is essentially giving the Biden administration a chance to see if they'll lift any of the sanctions before actually going ahead with it. Now, President Rouhani has expressed concerns about the draft resolution and said earlier this week that he has no doubt the U.S. will rejoin the Iran nuclear deal and lift all the sanctions. Iran's leader also addressed the topic of sanctions in a televised statement this week. He said there are two ways to tackle sanctions. Number one is removing them. Number two is to nullify and overcome them. He said that Iran tried the first option, tried removing sanctions by negotiating for a few years, but to no use. The second option, he said, may have difficulties in the beginning, but will have a favorable end. And indeed, that does seem to be what Iran has been doing. You know, what the United States and its Treasury Department did not consider is that Iran does not rely solely on oil. Iran has a very diverse economy with many means to fall back on and is able to barter and still navigate around the sanctions with other allies in the region and internationally. Even though the economy is in a bad shape because of the sanctions and people are suffering and dying, it is still a mark of resilience. And the country has been able to withstand sanctions, not just now, but for the last 40 years. This is something that Iranians, Syrians, and other peoples targeted by the U.S. empire know all too well. The United States thinks that it can cripple these countries and slowly choke off their resources. But ironically, it ends up forcing them to adopt self-sufficiency, bringing them closer to each other, increasing cooperation, and letting them find new intuitive ways to deal with the harsh measures imposed on them. Venezuela, for example, which has also been targeted by this maximum pressure campaign and that's economic terrorism from the U.S., was able to fulfill its fuel needs by trading directly with Iran. Even Iran's defense capabilities have proven to be formidable, especially for a country under economic duress. Just this August, we saw Iran unveil two new missiles, a cruise missile named after the martyred Abu Mahdi Mohandes, and a ballistic missile named after the martyred Haj Qasem. Despite these brutal sanctions, we've seen Iran develop its own COVID-19 testing, working on its own vaccine. We've seen Iran helping Syria in its fight against the foreign-backed terrorists sent by the West. We've also seen Iran send aid to its brothers in Venezuela, who are also engaged in the fight against Western imperialism and suffering under the same brutal sanctions. Even in public infrastructure. Just look at how Iran is doing better than the country sanctioning it, the United States, which is supposedly the richest nation on earth. Once again, through its imperialist foreign policy, the United States exposes itself as incapable of engaging in genuine substantive diplomacy. based on mutual respect and cooperation. Instead, the U.S. prefers to engage in conquest, siege warfare, economic terrorism, subjecting millions of people around the globe to inhumane and crippling sanctions. But if anything, this has shown Iran to be resilient and strong and capable of enduring even in the face of adversity. And Iran remains steadfast in its fight against imperialism along with its brothers in Syria and Venezuela and the Global South, and they will not be defeated. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
General Qasem Soleimani was a high-ranking Iranian military official whose popularity began to rise after he led the war on Daesh terrorists on the battlefields in Syria and Iraq. General Qasem Soleimani was the commander of Iran's Quds Force, the foreign arm of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was of great help to Syria as an advisor and organizer of Syrian troops when Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists launched a bloody assault on Syria in 2011. He also played a key role in creating Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, also known as Hashd al-Shaabi, in 2014, when Daesh declared its caliphate in Iraq and overran several provinces there. Hashd al-Shaabi later managed to defeat Daesh and drive the terrorist group out of Iraq. These victories for Syrian and Iraqi forces further increased General Soleimani's popularity among the Iraqis, Syrians, and Iranians. When General Soleimani declared the end of the Daesh Caliphate in 2018, the United States, which called itself the savior of the Iraqi and Syrian people, described him as its arch enemy and an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. The U.S. imposed sanctions on Soleimani. The Israeli regime also put Soleimani on its so-called terror list. In the year 2020, the assassination of General Soleimani and Hashd al-Shaabi's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a U.S. drone strike raises a key question. Was the United States really fighting Daesh? Or as U.S. President Donald Trump himself has said, was Daesh created by his predecessor Barack Obama? Perhaps now it would be easier to answer this question after the assassination of General Soleimani. What is clear is that the United States has killed a man who played the biggest role in both eliminating Daesh from the region and isolating Washington. Following this terrorist attack and the martyrdom of a group of people who had fought Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists round the clock, the question is, who really wants peace and stability in the region? And who is after igniting a war to plunder the Middle East?
In the limelight.
Palestinians have long complained that Facebook and other social media platforms have targeted their accounts, often deleting them without warning or explanation. Sadal Social Center, a non-government organization that monitors the treatment of Palestinian-focused content on the web, said it has recently received many complaints from managers of Palestinian and Arab pages on Facebook regarding a sharp drop of 50% of the general average, and in some cases, more than 80% in the number of users viewing their posts. In recent years, the Zionist regime's cyber unit has been cracking down on what it calls incitement by arresting Palestinians over their social media posts. In 2018, the Palestinian Prisoner Center reported that more than 500 people, including children, had been taken into custody for their posts. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Watchdog says Facebook behind intentional decrease in traffic to pro-Palestinian pages. Here's the details of this article. Facebook has allegedly been throttling posts concerning the Israeli regime human rights crimes and abuses in occupied Palestine, resulting in an intentional decrease in traffic by as much as 80%, an online watchdog group said on Wednesday, December 23rd. Sada Social Center, a non-government organization that monitors the treatment of Palestinian-focused content on the web, said it has recently received many complaints from managers of Palestinian and Arab pages on Facebook regarding a sharp drop of 50% of the general average, and in some cases, more than 80% in the number of users viewing their posts. The group also said that the Arabic language pages have also recently noticed a marked increase in receiving reports and warning messages from Facebook regarding publications related to the Palestinian cause, and these pages actively participated in covering the matter of Arab normalization with the Zionist regime occupation. Palestinians have long complained that Facebook and other social media platforms have targeted their accounts, often deleting them without warning or explanation. According to the Middle East Eye website, Facebook has previously cooperated with the Israeli regime to scrutinize Palestinian content on its platform. In October 2016, an Israeli regime minister revealed that Facebook complied with around 95% of requests submitted by the Israeli regime to delete the accounts of Palestinian civilians, almost 88% of whom consume their news and get their information from social media platforms like Facebook. In October, Sada Social, citing 139 violations of what it said were international law and basic human rights by Facebook, helped launch the hashtag FBB Block Palestine to broaden awareness of what it called the threat posed by Facebook against Palestinian content, as well the double standard policy of Facebook management in dealing with the Israeli regime incitement on its site. A cursory glance at the Facebook page of Israel Defense Forces, in contrast, reveals many photos of its troops holding guns. Also in October, Sada Social reported that Twitter had shot down dozens of Palestinian and sympathetic accounts one day after the Zionist regime Ministry of Strategic Affairs published a report on what it said were fake online profiles trying to delegitimize the fake regime of Israel. The problem goes beyond mere social censorship. In recent years, the Israeli regime cyber unit has been cracking down on what it calls incitement by arresting Palestinians over their social media posts. In 2018, the Palestinian Prisoners Center reported that more than 500 people, including children, had been taken into custody for their posts. Sada Social is calling on Facebook to clarify its reason for throttling pro-Palestinian posts, which it called a clear infringement and manipulation of users' rights. The group also urged international human rights bodies to follow up on the case and the flagrant infringement it reflects on freedom of opinion and expression.
around the world with reporters.
The floating sulfur reservoir north of the port of Hodeidah, which carries a million barrels of crude oil, poses a great environmental risk since it has not been put under any maintenance since the beginning of the war on Yemen. Recently, an agreement was reached between Sana'a and the United Nations to maintain the reservoir. Sana'a has already signed the agreement, while the UN is still stalling until today.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs facilitated the entry of technical experts for the maintenance of the safer tank, as it was agreed upon in July. But we were surprised by the United Nations postponement of the operation to February next year, and we do not know about the reasons. We hope the United Nations will expedite the dispatch of maintenance teams for the safer tank, because if a leak occurred, it would constitute a major disaster.
The Supreme Economic Committee confirms that the United Nations has not yet signed the agreement and surprised everyone by delaying the arrival of experts until February 15th, which could cause a disaster because the water had already entered the engine of the tanker, threatening it to sink or explode.
The United Nations is using the safer oil vessel as a pretext to impose political and economic pressure on the government of Sana'a. The Saudi-led coalition, on the other hand, has also used the tanker to implement its own agenda, despite greater dangers that also threatening the Suez Canal.
The delay of the maintenance operation, as well as the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi coalition, has led to an oil derivative crisis from which Yemenis have been suffering for months. This has also reflected negatively on the health sector.
Experts confirm that the sinking of the reservoir will cause an environmental catastrophe from which Yemen will not recover for more than 30 years until it gets rid of the dire consequences of contamination. The crisis will also cause the extinction of millions of marine life from the Red Sea. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a, Yemen.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. It will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Since its independence in November 1948, Lebanon, the small Arab country, has been the scene of a myriad of conflicts, challenges, and political bickering. The year 2020 was not unlike any other year, but even more challenging. As the country was engulfed in the economic, financial, and monetary crisis, another challenge hit the global scene in the form of a novel coronavirus. The first few positive cases of COVID-19 in Lebanon forced the country, like the rest of the world, into a lockdown. This lockdown was preceded by an unseen monetary crisis where the Lebanese lira plummeted against the U.S. dollar. U.S. sanctions on Lebanon led banks to limit cash withdrawals, and queues were seen daily facing banks. Observers look at the year 2020 as being one of the darkest periods in Lebanon's history.
We've lost everything, literally. You know, we've lost the companies, we've lost the banks, we've lost the economical system, we've lost the political system. There's nothing left. And you know, when you have nothing left, the only thing left is humans and their potentials.
The overall system of governance in Lebanon is seen as something that needs to end. Waking up to a new crisis had become a norm until the Beirut port blast. A large amount of ammonium nitrate exploded. The explosion ripped through the port of Beirut, killing over 200 people and wounding over 6,500, destroying large parts of the city. With a multifaceted crisis in the Mediterranean country, the explosion in the Beirut port in August of 2020 only served as an additional, unprecedented blow and a national tragedy for all Lebanese. However, politicians and the media remained intensely at odds.
We're used to, you know, Israeli attacks. We're used to having a little bit of, you know, security incidents on the ground. But we have never been used to something so huge. As huge as it is, I guess it was great for uniting the Lebanese over, you know, a cause. At this time and during the blast, we didn't find part of the Lebanese being happy for, you know, blasting another part of Lebanon. It was like, you know, general for all sects, for all people. And I guess it was a turning point because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that at this point we really need to rethink the political system in Lebanon. It was the first time he ever said that publicly on air.
Following the blast, Prime Minister Hassan Diab was forced to step down in respect for the victims. Investigations into the blast are still pending. Same goes for talks on forming a new government. Although the majority of Lebanese factions agreed to name Saad Hariri as prime minister, it seems the year 2020 will end and the formation of a new government remains in limbo. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Palestinian Refugees Committee in the Gaza Strip organized a rally against the UN AIDS and Health Services reduction. Palestinian refugees who have impacted badly by this reduction participated in the demonstration, calling for the world body's attention to the dire condition in the impoverished enclave.
It's our right to get the UN's aid services. People here are living in a deteriorating condition amid the pandemic. People here can't afford living, and now, with the reduction of the UN aid services, their life is getting even worse.
Palestinians believe the reduction in aid services by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, is an attempt by the U.S. to liquidate the humanitarian organization. Earlier, the U.S. announced plans to withhold $65 million of aid to the UNRWA until further notice.
The UN aid services reduction will have dire consequences as it deprives the Palestinian refugees from their basic rights. The reduction comes amid a critical political time as Israel is stepping up its pressure on the Palestinians.
By reducing the refugees' aid, the UN is standing beside the Israeli occupation at the expense of Palestinians' rights. We are calling for our rights, and the UN should fulfill its commitments.
The demonstrators call on the international community to reverse the reduction decision by the UN and keep on supporting the Palestinian refugees who have lost their lands and were expelled since 1948.
The reduction policy aims at reducing the aid services step by step until Palestinians are completely deprived of their rights. The UNRWA was established to help and support Palestinian refugees. The reduction policies serve Israel's interests.
UNRWA was established to aid the 700,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their homes during the war surrounding Israeli occupation's establishment in 1948.
More than the half of the 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on support from UNRWA, and depriving them from the services they need will worsen the living conditions. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Some 12 million children are facing a nightmare in Yemen, where one child dies every 10 minutes from preventable disease and the lack of healthcare services due to the ongoing war and the blockade imposed by the Saudi coalition.
We are about to enter the 7th year since the start of the aggression against our country, which has greatly affected the humanitarian situation, especially for children, who are the most affected segment in all aspects of life, such as health, education, social and other aspects, and they have lost all the rights guaranteed by international human rights law.
The numbers of affected children continue to grow each day. 2.1 million children are acutely malnourished and 358,000 severely malnourished, meaning that some children are already suffering under famine-like conditions. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ministry of Health held a press conference to shed more light on the dire conditions of children in the country.
What the children of Yemen suffer as a result of the Saudi aggression and blockade since March 2015 is a real humanitarian catastrophe by all international standards. More than 2,400,000 children are deprived of education, and more than 3 million children are homeless. Malnutrition, which is spreading among children, has been condemned by international organizations and is said to be the result of not getting enough food.
Saudi Arabia has committed countless atrocities against children in Yemen, where children are also targeted by airstrikes. The air attacks have killed thousands of children and left thousands more suffering from disabilities, not to mention travel restrictions on thousands of patients, including children who need to travel for treatment.
As the world is silently watching an entire people being deprived of the basics of life, Yemen has become the most dangerous place in the world for children to grow up, according to UNICEF. Abdul Latif Al-Washari, Sana'a.
The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, dissolved itself and the unity cabinet collapsed, pushing the Israelis into yet another early election on 23rd of March that would be the fourth in 2 years. The Knesset dispersed after failing to meet the legal deadline for approving a budget for 2020. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of the conservative Likud party had refused to present a budget in violation of his coalition agreement with his main rival turned partner Benny Gantz of the centrist Blue and White party.
The dissolving of the Knesset was simply because of Netanyahu's unwillingness to give up the premiership. The very possible scenario is the return of another political impasse for Israel. So Netanyahu will not be able to form a coalition that's satisfying and acceptable for all parties. We may even witness a fifth election after the upcoming vote.
Experts, however, say the dissolving of the Knesset would have been more advantageous for Netanyahu. It's not only a deep distrust between Netanyahu and Gantz. Netanyahu was gambling on another election in the hope of forming a right-wing religious cabinet that would grant him some kind of immunity from prosecution.
Netanyahu's corruption trial is scheduled to move into an intensive evidentiary stage in early 2021, requiring his regular presence in court. The current cabinet will remain in place in a caretaker capacity until after the election, and the formation of a new cabinet is a process that could take many months. However, the Israelis are convinced that there isn't any guarantee that the fourth election would finally end Israel's internal dogged stalemate. According to observers, Netanyahu has triggered early elections in an attempt to stay in power beyond his current term. However, they add that Netanyahu's fight for re-election is a difficult battle, mainly as his corruption trial is scheduled to resume with witness testimony next February. Mona Kandeep, Occupy, Ramallah.
Every year ahead of Christmas, this street in downtown Tehran gets packed with Christian residents in the capital, a rush to buy last-minute items to celebrate the birth of Jesus. This year, however, the hustle and bustle is gone, as the coronavirus pandemic has emptied the streets and pushed people into their homes. Many families cannot celebrate the festive season together. But Christians here say this does not mean they should abandon the celebrations when they can do it online.
Happy New Year and Merry Christmas to all. This year we miss all the family gatherings, but it's all right. We can catch up with each other using video calls. I hope that in the new year, the pandemic will be gone.
Merry Christmas to all Iran and all the world. And in spite of that we have this pandemic time, I wish everybody will have very soon good times, and 2021 will be happy for every of us.
Nearly 120,000 Christians live in Iran. The majority of them are Armenians, who follow the Oriental Orthodox branch of Christianity. While they make up less than 1% of the Iranian population, they feel at home when it comes to Christmas.
You know, the Christmas.
Merry Christmas. It's good to see the Christmas atmosphere running deep here in Iran, where the majority are Muslims. We feel at home here.
Iran has for the past month been under nationwide lockdown to contain the resurging virus. This has curtailed religious ceremonies across the red zones in the country, and church rituals are no exception.
While 2020 was not a happy year, Christians here say it taught humanity a great lesson, to value even the shortest moments with their loved ones. Now on this year's Christmas, Happy New Year is more than just a wish, and everyone is praying that in 2021, the coronavirus will be a thing of the past. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Karina was a working mom with a job in the tourism sector, decimated by the pandemic. With no savings to fall back on, and with her husband's delivery job earnings nowhere near enough for them to get by, they ended up in a position no one wants to find themselves.
I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Karina's quest for help led her to Educare Family Support Service, one of many publicly funded companies helping families down on their luck in the age of COVID.
We have lots of different food items that will go in. The plan behind it was that we would be able to prepare hampers for families, who disadvantaged families who may not be able to afford to have a Christmas meal or Boxing Day meal. So we've ensured that we've provided a hamper with everything excluding the meat. At the moment, we're on about 270. Literally, that is 270 families.
270 of many more families facing food insecurity and hunger, exacerbated by the pandemic, a situation that's drawn in UNICEF for the first time in its 70-year history in this country.
In these unprecedented times, I would imagine that these families have become known to their professionals that they're engaging with and are now require additional support.
This cavernous space is the interior of an Anglican church in West London. In normal times, it would see worshippers kneeling in prayer. Today, it's dedicated to something more pressing, getting food into people's cupboards.
I got quite emotional, actually, about, you know, just the thought that you're privileged and get to enjoy Christmas and then other people are going without, especially at the moment with these troubled times. So I thought, if I can come and make just a little bit of difference.
These hampers are being stuffed with supplies to last families for a few days. People used to go to food banks to pick them up. Since the onset of COVID, the whole project of compassion has taken on a new dimension, deliveries.
These volunteer drivers will be dropping off food and presents at hundreds of households for the next 3 days. A drop in the bucket considering the number of families depending on these supplies. And some of those families have up to 6 children.
Most of these volunteers found out about this project on social media. Some of them have dedicated their only day off to being here.
To see the family smiles and the people who need the things is, you know, I can't explain what you feel. The smile of them faces just can give me the energy. They can make my day.
Some have brought their young ones along so they can see firsthand what their less fortunate peers are going through. Those with bigger vehicles have come as couples to help transport more of this humanitarian assistance to homes where kitchen cabinets are not restocked as often as they should.
It's nothing for me to offer a couple of hours, so we're also in a position where it could be me who needs this support.
This year has been very contrasting in the fact that there's some people just getting richer and richer and richer, and we're reaching rock bottom, really, in sense of community is getting destroyed, really.
If you're feeding a family of 4 to 6 people, that's going to last, 2 days. It will get them through till Christmas Eve, hopefully.
And we all think we're struggling. Karina has had to adapt to her new world, caring for her 3-year-old daughter in a small rented apartment with no garden while her husband works, and looking after her ailing father who lives on his own.
I know a lot of people are suffering during this difficult time. It's very challenging, but you have to be positive at all times. Seek for help. If you don't ask, you don't get it.
Karina is perhaps one of the tens of thousands of families, if not more, for whom survival depends on charitable donations. Saeed Pourizza, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It is hard to comprehend the magnitude of the crisis in Yemen. Approximately one child dies every 12 minutes in a country where 24 million people need humanitarian aid. Nearly 18 million people have no access to clean drinking water, a problem that will worsen in the future. For Yemenis, COVID-19 was only the latest epidemic. The country has in recent years faced outbreaks of malaria, dengue, and cholera. Even the outbreak of COVID-19 did not stop the Saudi-led U.S.-supported violence. As a result of new attacks, more than 18,600 people died between January 1st and December 5th, 2020, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, ACLED. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Isa Ferreira Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Yemen's Humanitarian Crisis Worsened Amid COVID. Stay tuned, please, for the details. For Yemen, 2020 has been an apocalyptic year, which has exceeded even the worst forecast for a country that has in recent years been ravaged by war and humanitarian disaster. Even the outbreak of COVID-19 did not stop the Saudi-led U.S.-supported violence. As a result of new attacks, more than 18,600 people died between January 1st and December 5th, 2020, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Events Data Project, that is ACLED. In a 2018 interview, Robert Malley, who led the West Asia desk of U.S. National Security Council during the Obama administration, recognized that the disastrous consequences of military intervention by the Saudi coalition was a very likely outcome. He said, "It was the poorest country, Yemen, to begin with, being bombed by the wealthiest country in the region, that is Saudi Arabia." Yemen has been the victim of a regional dispute, but also of Western powers. A coalition led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which the European Council on Foreign Relations describes as having access to some of the most sophisticated and expensive military technologies in the world, has been able to use the bloodiest tactics. As Martha Mundy, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at the London School of Economics, wrote in her report, "The strategies of coalition in the Yemeni war, these include a blockade on sea, land, and air, which used hunger as a method of war, and indiscriminate attacks on the civilian population and food production. To commit such atrocities, the Saudi coalition needed decisive logistical assistance from countries including the United States and the United Kingdom. The consequences have been brutal." According to a report from April 2019 by the Paris Center for the United Nations Development Programme, as well as data from ACLED, the death toll in the nation since the beginning of the war far exceeds 250,000 and may even be close to 300,000. It is hard to comprehend the magnitude of the crisis in Yemen. Approximately one child dies every 12 minutes in the country, where 24 million people need humanitarian aid. Donald Trump's foreign policy has repeatedly tried to undermine the humanitarian crisis in the poorest countries. Two such recent attempts were the efforts to suspend aid to Yemen in March of this year, followed by Trump's decision, announced in May, that the U.S. would leave the World Health Organization, which will have a disastrous effect if Biden does not rejoin the organization. The U.S. withdrawing its funding will translate into abandonment of millions of people who depend on these funds to survive in Yemen. These endeavors were unsurprising considering the Trump administration's support and its blank check for Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Meanwhile, there are high expectations for the new administration. Despite having been the vice president under Barack Obama, who supported the war in Yemen, Biden has been pushed to reassess the U.S. relation with Saudi Arabia due to pressure from progressives and unpopularity of the war. The war is not the only catastrophe to have befallen Yemen this year. Heavy rains between spring and summer caused immense damage and displaced 300,000. In fact, Yemen is a clear example of the tragic consequences of the climate crisis, the effects of which amount to more than just floods. Nearly 18 million people have no access to clean drinking water, a problem that will worsen in the future. For Yemenis, COVID-19 was only the latest epidemic. The country has in recent years faced outbreaks of malaria, dengue, and cholera. That latter is a perfectly preventable disease that should be eradicated, reminds us that while the world was seeking vaccines for COVID-19, people in Yemen were suffering the consequences of living without clean water. Worse still, the healthcare system in Yemen has practically collapsed. The extent of COVID-19 outbreak in Yemen is not currently known, but it is likely that the number of deaths in the country is much higher than the 607 deaths reported by WHO. Satellite imagery used to estimate the burials between April and September in the port city of Aden, but the excess mortality in the area at 2,100 compared to 1,300 deaths expected. The economy is also in ruin. Since 2015, the value of the Yemeni rial has fallen to $800, down by more than two-thirds of its pre-war value, while the population increasingly depends on the remittances that Yemenis send from countries such as Saudi Arabia. But these payments have also been affected by the COVID-19 crisis, as many overseas workers lost their jobs, meaning the money being sent home fell dramatically. The international community worsened the disastrous situation when it began to reduce humanitarian funds sent to Yemen. This has had dire consequences, and the United Nations has called for more funds to prevent humanitarian programs from collapsing, warning that millions of children are facing deadly hunger. Mark Lowcock, the UN's Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, warned that the humanitarian crisis in Yemen has never been worse, while the Secretary General Antonio Guterres recently claimed that Yemen is now in imminent danger of suffering the worst famine that the world has been in decades. As Lowcock said, Yemenis are not going hungry, they are being starved. Less than half of the humanitarian aid requested by the UN has been sent. That is, a further $1.75 billion is required. Meanwhile, tens of billions of dollars were spent on Western arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates during the war. This contrast invites reflection. The duty of democratic countries is to avoid unimaginable disaster. There is no time. Western governments must act now by stopping sending arms and instead providing immediate funds to the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
You'll clear there and left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, no nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward and the worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt. And it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath though.
Yeah, well, me too.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze, well, you've got it all over you. You're wet through some bloody days.
What, just covered in stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean one.
Oh, right, okay.
About there.
About there?
Yeah.
Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole and they crunched them up with a dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on. Digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
Drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to snip around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 2,4,5-T, which was thought to be more toxic than 2,4-D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 2,4,5-T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can
not ensure that dioxins are not being formed, even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 2,4,5-T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
What many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 2,4-D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 2,4-D.
2,4-D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 2,4-D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is a sample.
Right.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 2,4-D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 2,4,5-T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 2,4-D. Tests on one 2,4-D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 2,4-D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case, that industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 2,4-D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 2,4-D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
2,4-D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 2,4-D?
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I would have to I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test